Good morning. My wife, Marietta, and I are here on behalf of the bishop, making a visitation in his stead, and so I bring greetings from him and from the diocese. Yesterday, we had our spring mission district meeting. How many folks? I know Margaret was there. Anybody else? Was there? Kirk was there. Dan was there. Okay. And so always good to see folks from around our area. So in a translation from David Bentley Hart, who is a scholar at Yale University and has translated the New Testament in a very interesting way, and without all of the, I guess I would call it, churchy baggage that comes with a lot of translations. The second line of this section of John's Gospel, he translates like this. The shepherd, the one who is good, lays down his soul for the sake of the sheep. A little bit different twist on that passage there. The gospel, according to John, is strikingly different from all the other stories about Jesus. And today, it is usually set aside, this whole section in chapter 10, because not only is it the fourth Sunday of Easter, I ran across somebody not too long ago and made some mention of it, and they said, "Aren't you done with that yet?" To which I replied, "Some of us are slower than others." So, fourth Sunday of Easter, it is also known as Good Shepherd Sunday, and today is also Earth Day, exactly. And so we look to those connections. But from the vantage point of this gospel, which begins with a poem portraying Jesus as an everlasting figure at one with God. And I want you to just hold that image as we continue on. That Jesus is portrayed, again, very differently from the other Gospels, as an everlasting figure at one with God. And one of the things that may not be immediately obvious is that the writer of John's Gospel and that ancient community out of which this story was generated intended the opening of the story, you remember, "In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God." All that beautiful poetic rendering. It was intended to be understood as another creation story. This is another creation story. So it begins big, epic. And again, Jesus is portrayed as this cosmic figure who stands in the crosshairs of human trauma, human loss, and human potential. This gospel of John makes a steady case for you and me to be a part of God. And you probably can recall some of the ways in which that is described. In elliptical language or spiral language, Jesus describes himself in John's Gospel as salt, light, bread, shepherd. And the elliptical language and the elliptical connections that he makes in this Gospel suggest that we, you and I, are in him, that he is in God, and that God is in him. So, you and I are in God, in Jesus. Now, one of the other images that arises in the Gospel of John is the phrase eternal life. And most of us have been taught or have assumed that this image has to do with dying and going to heaven. And it does not. In fact, it has nothing to do with that whatsoever. Crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension, which in John's gospel are all one event, also have nothing to do with dying and going to heaven. You and I are invited in this narrative to experience eternal life. The Greek phrase is zoein aionion, or the life of the eons, in this life, as we currently live and breathe. And that living in God through, again, an everlasting figure who is at one with God. And if you can accept the notion, as the ancient ones did, that the opening of John's gospel, the prologue, is a creation story, then it was also understood in ancient times, and you and I need to recapture this sense that the relationship, who's in who, we're in Jesus, Jesus is in God, God is in Jesus, also includes the earth. Over the years, I've noticed and become more aware of the language of our liturgy. And those of you that are familiar, for instance, with Eucharistic Prayer C, this fragile earth, our island home, beautiful. It's my favorite Eucharistic prayer. But there's one line in that prayer that's become like nails on a chalkboard for me, when it says in address to God, and you made us the rulers of creation. Do you remember that line? It is my humble opinion that that line's got to go, because it plays off of a fantasy that Christianity bought into during the Middle Ages, and in particular, kicked in hard come the Industrial Revolution and what we have for a long time misidentified as enlightened, you know, the Enlightened Era, that we're to dominate the earth, that we're to dominate and control creation. And if you go back to those ancient stories, that couldn't be farther from the truth. And so, for instance, in that one little line, I would lobby, and in fact, you'll see if you ever came to St. Peter's and took a sneak peek through the altar missal, that's scratched out. Don't tell the bishop, please. And the line that we use at St. Peter's is, and you made us the stewards of creation. I'm sure there are other words that you folks could think of as well. Another example, pull out a Book of Common Prayer and take a look at page 304, page 304, no, excuse me, 305. Page 305. You'll see there familiar language. It is the language of our covenant, the one that we renew anytime the congregation gathers for baptism, and also on those high holy days like Pentecost coming up, and, excuse me, at the great vigil of Easter. And at the top of page 305, I refer you to the last two questions, which, again, we've taken liberty to amend. Based on this new and expanded understanding of our tradition as it's embedded in the scriptures, that second last question, will you seek and serve Christ in all persons and in all creation? We added that line at St. Peter's. Loving your neighbor as yourself, the implication being that now you and I are challenged to see the earth as neighbor and as part of the neighborhood. And then the last one, will you strive for justice and peace among all people and respect the dignity of every living thing? This is not new. I mean, again, go to the scriptures. You'll find this language embedded deeply in our primary source. And so it behooves us, especially on a day like Earth Day, to recognize those connections and that deep structure of our tradition that calls us to see our relationship with the earth as a partnership, as a neighborhood, as a neighbor, as an entity, as a that in which we are in relationship with. And so, big old challenge in that regard. And so, again, John's Gospel invites us to imagine that we are at one through an everlasting figure who is at one with God and, bless you, and all of creation. So, some examples of this. When we get to the prayers of the people, I love what you folks have done with these prayers. They're wonderful because they reach out and claim this ancient part of our tradition. But some quick stories. In Carson City this past year, we had the honor and the privilege of partnering up with four other congregations in town to house the homeless in our parish halls during the coldest months of the winter. In fact, our turn was the month of March. We had folks in our parish hall and our library every night. Between eight congregations in Carson City, we had 150-some volunteers through this effort. And here's some spectacular things that happened, unforeseen certainly by me. One is that now there are 150-some people in those eight congregations who know each other because they volunteered, spent night after night together in shifts, talking with each other, getting to know one another, snoozing together, you know, if necessary, but being in this together. So that was a wonderful side effect of this effort. And we now have about half of the parish at St. Peter's who knows about 40 homeless in Carson City by first name. And I would submit that when we get to know our homeless by first name, that we're experiencing the invitation of the gospel according to John, being at one with each other and all things. I came across an article just recently that is entitled, "More Than Half Your Body Is Not Human." Human cells make up only 43% of the human body's total cell count. Did you people know this? Did you know this? I had never run across this stuff. Cellular biologists, microbiologists apparently have been studying this stuff for decades, who knows how long, and now the truth is starting to come out. So if my math serves, this is a bit of a stretch, 57%, is that right? What's left? 50% of our bodies are not human cells. You can imagine what makes up that 57%. Bacteria, viruses, fungi. I didn't like that part too much. And other stuff that they said they misclassify as bacteria, but that's beyond my pay grade. Anyway, I just was floored by this information, and it goes on, and there's all kinds of stuff about DNA and genomes, which I know absolutely nothing about. But get this, the scientists are saying, gee whiz, it's kind of a new way of thinking about the world and about our relationship to it if we're only 43% human, and which might explain a thing or two. Just kidding. To date, our relationship with microbes has largely been one of warfare. Think about that. Just let that settle in. I mean, the way we use antibiotics, the way we use medicines, and now there are super viruses and super bugs and all kind of, you know, and now we're discovering we may have shot ourselves in the foot. Again, we are connected to the rest of the earth and the universe in ways that I could have never imagined except through information like that from the scientists. And then this past week, Marietta and I had the pleasure of being in Washington, D.C. at a conference, and we had a couple of days where we could sneak out and check out the sites. One of the places we went, which I've visited before, is the Vietnam Memorial. And I'm sure, as do I, that you have names on that wall, people that you know and love, perhaps people you went to school with, cousins and family and whatnot. It's a pretty powerful experience to see the 58,000+ names of those who died during the Vietnam conflict. And then, and again, as you enter into that memorial, if you've been, there's this sense of deep and abiding connection. And then, on the way out of town on Friday, there we are at Reagan National Airport, and they announced that our flight is delayed. Now, I don't know about you, but when I get information like that, I get a little attitude and think, who do these people think they are, you know, making me late for whatever it is I think I'm late for? But then we found out there were all these people that were starting to show up, and they were lining the terminal where we got onto the ramp to go down to the plane, and Marietta went over because she actually talks to people. And she found out that the reason our flight was delayed was that there were a bunch of guys who served in World War II, the Korean War, and the Vietnam, the early part of the Vietnam War, and this was an honor flight. Have you heard of this? Oh my gosh. When these guys started coming off that plane, I mean, the whole terminal was eyes focused on that ramp. Every eye. I mean, people are standing on countertops and chairs, and when they came off that plane, the place went wild. I mean, it was one of the most powerful things I've ever witnessed and had the privilege of participating in. And there we are, and I'm telling you, Jesus was in Terminal A at Reagan National when those guys were coming off that plane. It was unbelievable. It was powerful, palpable. And this deep and abiding sense of all of us being connected. Whew. And then, How many of you folks read National Geographic? I've asked you this question before, I'm sure. Anybody? You read this month's issue? It's pretty amazing. I would encourage, even if you don't subscribe, check it out. It's on race. And again, like this, these studies they're doing where they're discovering we're only 43% human cells, they're also discovering that there is no such thing as race. I mean, there are no differences between any of us except the color of our skin. We're all exactly the same. And yet, we haven't necessarily lived that way over the course of our lives, certainly as a culture. Anyway, the very last article in this month's issue describes a gentleman named Brian Stevenson, who is involved in an enormous justice project in Georgia and wrote this lovely book called Just Mercy. And it shows him in a memorial display where people traveled the United States and found and are continuing to find the various places where our African American brothers and sisters were lynched, hunted down like dogs, tortured, stabbed, shot, hung, you know, lynched for white privilege, pretty much. And so they're traveling the country, and when they find these places where folks were lynched, they're digging up the earth, and they're putting it in jars. And each of those jars, with that dirt, has the name of the person that was lynched. And they're placed on shelves all along an enormous wall. They currently have about 300 of these jars. And, I mean, talk about a connection to the earth, right? I mean, and this is part of the dark, the shadow side of our history that really has yet to be named or spoken of or claimed or embraced by us as a nation. And yet, you know, here it's being embodied. And to see the photo of all these jars of earth where folks were killed is pretty powerful stuff. And again, to see this and experience it and hear the stories of these people and realize once again that we are all connected deeply and inextricably. And to the extent that we're able, primarily for you and me, through the images of Jesus as an everlasting figure at one with God, if we can lean into that and become that invitation that Jesus issues when he says, oh yeah, I'm the good shepherd. I'm salt and light and bread. That you and I can experience the life of the eons, eternal life, crucifixion, resurrection, ascension, now, here, in this life. And be looking for all of those opportunities to see our connections with ourselves and the microbes that inhabit us, with each other, with the earth, and with God. And all through Jesus, this everlasting figure at one with God, who precedes and follows us everywhere we go.